In the past 2 days on this program, we've looked into how the Chinese government uses modern technology to monitor its population to a point where it could be called a surveillance state. Now, there's some evidence that surveillance extends well beyond China's borders. The New York Times says that for the past 4 months, its computer system has been systematically hacked, and it is accusing the Chinese government of being behind it. The New York Times says the hacking was tied to the paper's investigation into how the family of China's prime minister, Wen Jiabao, accumulated billions of dollars in business deals. Nicole Perlroth reports on cybersecurity for The New York Times, including on this particular story, and she joined us on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
So when did The Times and how did The Times realize it was being hacked?
Sure. So leading up to the publication of that story, our security team actually asked AT&T, which monitors our network, to look out for some unusual activity. And on October 25th, the same day we published, we heard back from them that they had seen behavior on our network consistent with other attacks they had seen perpetrated by the Chinese military.
What was the hacker's goal?
It was very clear from the start that they were after David Barbosa's email correspondence. David was the Shanghai bureau chief who wrote the investigation into Mr. Wen's relatives. And his sources for the story, ironically enough, were actually publicly available documents. There wasn't anyone that actually came and dumped a bunch of documents on his lawn or anything that the Chinese government would have found in his email account that would have been helpful. But it was very clear from the beginning that they were after David's email correspondence.
So in a sense, you might say they didn't get much because there wasn't much for them to get.
That's correct.
Now, aside from the fact that you're saying those who were targeted were your China journalists, what is the evidence that these hackers come from China, have anything to do with China itself, or are connected to the Chinese government?
Sure. So the malware that they had used was previously seen in hundreds of other attacks, and the command and control centers they used were known to have been used by the Chinese military in previous attacks.
What has China said about these accusations?
They've denied them. They said, we have laws in place that prevent this from happening, and to accuse the Chinese military is, I think the quote was, quote-unquote, unprofessional.
Nicole Perlroth, you report on cybersecurity for The New York Times, and you knew that this hacking was going on?
Yes, it's an interesting spot to be in, to be covering this, and I'll tell you why. You know, since I started covering cybersecurity, there are a number of companies that have come out in the last year that I've been on this beat that have accused China of breaking into their systems. So Lockheed Martin says it's regularly targeted. Northrop Grumman says it's attacked on a daily basis. And of course, no company wants to come forward and voluntarily say, hey, we were hacked by China. Here's how it happened. Here's what they took. Because they're probably scared what it will do for their stock price or their reputations. And in this case, you know, what was interesting was that it was my own employer that had been hacked. And we felt that it was very important to come out with this and say, this is how easy it is for them to break into any U.S. company. And here's how they're doing it.
Nicole Perlroth reports on cybersecurity for The New York Times. She was speaking to us from San Francisco. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Renee.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, millions of Americans sat down to watch the Super Bowl last night, and you can admit it. We know you wanted to see the ads. We'll be checking in with TV critic Eric Dagans about the ads that hit or missed or pushed some people's buttons, not in a good way. That's coming up. But first today, we begin a series to observe Black History Month. And this year, we decided to speak with African Americans on the cutting edge. For our series this month, we are going to speak with innovators who have excelled in science, technology, engineering, and math, the so-called STEM fields. And we begin today with pilot and educator Barrington Irving. He set a world record in 2007 at the age of 23. He was both the youngest person and the first Black man to fly around the world alone. Here he is talking about that trip at a 2011 TED conference in Miami.
My airplane, due to a downdraft, descended from 20,000 feet to 9,200 feet. Now, two things happened in that moment. The first thing that happened was, of course, I did the right things. I added full power, was able to climb out. The second thing that happened in that moment was that I needed an extra set of underwear.
Now, at the ripe old age of 29, he has recently been recognized by National Geographic as an emerging explorer. His latest mission is building a flying classroom to give kids the experience of seeing mathematics in action. And Barrington Irving joins us now from Miami member station WLRN. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, I'm just so excited to be on this with you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Let's just start with the idea, and then you can talk about the inspiration to do what you did.
Didn't have a
private plane in the driveway?
Oh, no, we weren't blessed with a private plane in the driveway. We certainly came from humble beginnings. Family moved here from Jamaica at the age of 6. My introduction to aviation was actually random. My parents had a small Bible bookstore. And one day during off-season while I was playing football, this gentleman walks into the store dressed in his pilot's uniform and says to me, "Hey, son, have you ever thought about becoming a pilot?" And I immediately just said to him, "I don't think I'm smart enough to do it." And he then said to me, "Oh, you know, if I can do it, you can do it." Then I asked him how much money he made. And after he answered that question, I took an interest in aviation, and interest turned into passion. And here I am today.
That's all you needed to hear, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, flying can be quite expensive. No disrespect to the military, but that's one reason why a number of people join the military. But you didn't want to wait for that. In fact, you weren't even old enough to join the military at the time when you started trying to learn how to fly. How did you do it?
I saved up my lunch money and skipped out on meals. My parents didn't know this. They would kill me. But was able to buy a $40 software made by Microsoft Flight Simulator. And on that software, although it was virtual, man, I was able to fly anywhere in the world and simulate certain weather conditions. And that really kept my interest for quite some time until I graduated high school and was able to work hard and afford flight lessons.
How did you actually figure out where to go to get flight lessons?
Actually, you'll be amazed at the number of resources out there as it relates to how to get involved in flight training. For me, it's kind of funny. I'll never forget. We were just so poor, and it's kind of embarrassing to say, but I'll say it anyway. There was a company who had a free six-month magazine subscription, you know, and it really talks about aviation and different career opportunities, and I couldn't afford, you know, anything beyond 6 months. So the first 6 months, my name was Barrington Irving, and then the next 6 months, it was Irving Barrington. And then 6 months after that, it was something else. But, you know, I was just hungry. You know, I was hungry to learn, and I was willing to work hard.
How did the idea of flying solo around the world take hold?
When I turned 21 years of age as a Black man, that really meant something to me. And I'll never forget asking myself the question, what's one thing I can do, whether I live or die, that would be worth something? And I'll never forget the idea hit me of, you know, what if I did a flight around the world? And the idea was great, but the next 2.5 years, I faced rejection after rejection. And my mental perspective, honestly, was, what do I have to lose? I have plenty of friends who didn't make it, or they got locked up. It's kind of interesting, you know, and to this day and age, I wear a brown flight suit, and I've seen others in brown suits, you know, that says Miami-Dade County Corrections Department. So it's, for me, in wanting to fly around the world, it was just solely to inspire others.
The fact is, it took you, you know, 2.5 years. You faced more than 50 rejections for sponsorships before you were finally able to convince several manufacturers to donate individual components. You took off, if I have this right, with, I'm not laughing, it's just, I'm just hard to envision, because I'm a mother too, and I'm thinking how I would feel if this was my son. No weather radar, no de-icing system, and $30 in your pocket.
Yep.
And when you landed, what did you see?
I come back and land, and I just literally see thousands of people at the airport waving banners and signs and congratulating me. And even the ones who tried to discourage me, or I knew they were expecting me to come back in a casket, fighting to shake my hand and to congratulate me. But what stuck out to me even more was just the amount of students that we had following me online and blogging with me, which was over 300,000 kids. And, you know, I'll never forget that moment. When I departed out of Miami, I only had $30 in my pocket, and I'm reading banners and signs that says, "Go Barrington, go." And I'm wondering to myself, where am I going? I only have $30 in my pocket. But sure enough, by the time I made my first stop, Miami fundraised close to $100,000. And the further I kept on going, the more money was raised.
Well, what are you up to now? What are you trying to do now? You've got a number of educational programs that you are involved in. Tell me a little bit about those.
Yeah, so the past few years for me since flying around the world has certainly been interesting. I've pretty much transitioned from being a pilot to also becoming an educator. And one of the first projects I tested was our Build and Soar program, where we challenged 60 kids from failing high schools in Miami to build an aircraft from scratch, and not only build it from scratch, but put my life on the line to fly it for its first flight. A number of those students have gone on to college. A number of them have gotten degrees in various fields. There's one young lady, Bakari, who at the time of that project, she couldn't point out a 16th of an inch on a ruler, and now she is on a full scholarship as a math major at Duke University.
Tell me about the flying classroom.
We're creating a real-life magic school bus by transforming a $5 million private aircraft donated by the Beechcraft Corporation into the world's first flying classroom. So what does that mean?
Well, hold on. For people who aren't familiar with, who don't have kids, the Magic School Bus is a series of books where the school bus magically takes kids on all kinds of adventures where they understand, you know, things like the rainforest, the core of the earth, the environment, stuff like that. And this is a real-life one.
Yep, now we've figured out a way to do it in real life where we will utilize this flying aircraft and be able to not only communicate with classrooms from the air, but we're traveling all seven continents where we'll conduct various expeditions. Could be around geothermal energy, biodiversity, innovations in technology. But we're doing it in a way where students actually control the results of every mission, from the meals I eat to the experiments that's conducted and the data and research that's collected. It's all done by the students virtually, and I'm just fulfilling the actions that they choose.
And when will this start?
This will start September of 2014, and we're just very excited to be able to collaborate with so many individuals and corporations to create classroom in the sky.
What do you think this means? What do you think is the lesson here?
It's interesting because the problem that we face in this country as it relates to STEMs, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, is a national problem. We need as many bodies that we can find to become the next leaders in those areas. And I found working with all types of students, this nation faces an even bigger problem. Our problem is the students of today are simply unmotivated, regardless of background or economic status. And I think what we're doing in education, we want to be the best, but we're afraid to challenge our kids to be the best. And that's where I put forth with action with some of the projects that we're doing. I don't say we're going to do something and expect our students to fail. Failure certainly isn't an option. Whether it's building a plane or having kids as young as 8 years old, building a car faster than a Ferrari, we have to put tangible challenges with real finish lines in front of these kids' faces. Because when a child has the opportunity to do those types of projects or anything hands-on or skills-based, They're not looking at, oh, I have to learn the math and science and algebra and chemistry and physics and so forth behind doing some of these things. They're looking at the finish line.
Barrington Irving is a pilot and educator who set a world record as the youngest person and the first black man to fly around the world alone. He spoke with us from WLRN in Miami. Barrington Irving, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations. And we can't wait to see what you do next.
All right. Take Bye. Care.
Iran has one of the highest percentages of internet access in the Middle East. But the number of sites Iranians can legally visit is extremely limited. The government has charged cyber police units with tracking those who try to visit banned internet or social media sites. Much of that policing targets pro-democracy activists. From Istanbul, NPR's Peter Kenyon reports on Iranian dissidents' struggle to maintain their online activism.
When the Ayatollah got a Facebook page in mid-December, Iranians sat up and blinked. Some thought it was a fake, finding it hard to believe that Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei would be using a technology that his own government blocks. A State Department spokeswoman skeptically wondered how many likes it would attract. But some of Khamenei's supporters quickly rallied behind the move, which first came to light in a reference on, you guessed it, the Ayatollah's Twitter account. For a time, Iran's millions of computer users allowed themselves to hope that it might lead to an unblocking of Facebook and other social media sites. Not so. They still have to pick the government's cyber locks to access the latest thoughts from their own leader. Of course, that's not the only site Iranians want to visit, and that's what has the authorities worried. After security forces crushed massive street protests following the controversial 2009 elections, activists took their dissent to the virtual world, where they now find themselves under increasingly aggressive attack.
The fight in the online space is not over.
Reza Ghazi Nouri is an activist who fled to Turkey when he was threatened with years in prison for his support of pro-reform candidates. His research into Iran's internet and social networking communities shows the increasing ability of government cyber police units to learn the identities of online writers, some of whom are then arrested, interrogated, and tortured. One brutal example came last November. A blogger named Sattar Beheshti was arrested for critical comments posted on Facebook. His death in custody after allegedly being tortured provoked international condemnation. Still, Nouri believes it had the desired chilling effect.
Because when you torture somebody to death for blogging and writing in Facebook, you're not just killing him, you're oppressing and frightening millions of other people.
Security analyst Theodore Karasik at the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis says after being caught off guard by the huge protests of 2009, the government has gotten much more savvy at stifling dissent online as well as in the streets.
It's not unusual for someone to get followed or to conduct their internet or social media sessions in another house or another location that they think is secure when in fact it really isn't. Indeed, there is a crackdown ongoing and will probably even get worse with the development of a Iran-only internet.
Technology analysts have debated Tehran's effort to seal off the country from the World Wide Web. Karasik sides with those who believe it can be done, while others doubt that a hermetic cyber seal could be maintained. There are tools, such as VPNs or virtual private networks, that allow Iranians to disguise their computer's identity. But according to activist Reza Nouri, some of the cheapest VPNs on the Iranian market are supplied by the Revolutionary Guard itself and provide no protection whatsoever. The crucial obstacle at the moment, he says, is organizing.
The problem is that you can have safe communications with two, three, or four people, but when you try to organize an event, you have to communicate to thousands of people. So that's not working.
The increased pressure has caused many opposition supporters to deactivate their Facebook accounts. Still, the authorities are preparing for a spike in activism as the June presidential contest approaches. Nouri says if the international community really wants to help pro-democracy forces in Iran, it should invest in internet freedom there. Meanwhile, the Ayatollah's Facebook page seems to be thriving. As of late January, it had been liked nearly 30,000 times. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
About the desirability of American manufacturing jobs and green jobs, President Obama talks about both very often.
We have doubled our use of renewable energy, and thousands of Americans have jobs today building wind turbines and long-lasting batteries.
Well, last week I visited a Massachusetts factory that doesn't build wind turbines or batteries, but it does make a product that is arguably a force for sustainability. Nearly 40 Americans assemble that product, and it's an interesting case study in innovation. It's a hand dryer. It's made by XL Dryer of East Longmeadow, Massachusetts, a company that Dennis Gagnon bought in the 1990s. By 1997, Gagnon knew that XL had a problem.
We had an experienced and dedicated workforce. We built a quality product. We had an excellent reputation for customer service. And we had a product that people hated to use.
Drying your hands took 35 to 40 seconds. By that time, lots of people with wet hands had either wiped them on their clothes or grabbed a paper towel. Well, luckily for Gagnon, a firm called Invent Resources promised a marriage made, if not in heaven, at least within Massachusetts.
We called ourselves Invention Upon Demand.
Richard Pavel was one of four scientists, three of them out of MIT, men who had done serious physics and applied mathematics, who would work with companies on ideas for new products, all kinds of products. By the 90s, Pavel had patented a putter with a big sweet spot. His idea for a hair dryer that blew dry air had failed to win over Conair. So he had a related idea, a dry air hand dryer.
It's clear that the use of very dry air can absorb more moisture than ambient air, and the use of shaped nozzles to better focus an airstream can help in the drying of hands. And using a force.
Pavel, the scientist turned inventor, phoned Gagnon, the entrepreneur.
It was clear in my mind that the hand dryer of the 21st century better dry your hands quickly, and if they could figure out a way to get there, I was all for proceeding.
Mind you, Richard Pavel and his colleagues had already run their idea for a faster hand dryer past World Dryer, which was the colossus in the field, the GM of hand dryers, and they'd been rejected. But when they invited Dennis Gagnon to a brainstorming session, the XL owner accepted.
And they would be at one after another at the chalkboard screaming at each other in Yiddish and arguing how to design this or do that. And just left there thinking, you know what, these guys are probably smart enough to help us figure out a way to do this.
The scientists determined that the old hand dryers wasted 90% of the energy going into them. A new hand dryer had to be more efficient. XL's own Tom Kaitch went to the milling machine and cut prototype after prototype. Richard Pavel recalls that the problem was balancing the unbearable noise of the machine against its drying power. How fast could you dry your hands with a machine that didn't make you flee the washroom, deafened by the experience?
We were shooting for 10 seconds.
10 seconds to dry your hands.
That was our goal. I don't think we ever achieved that goal, but we got down to certainly under 15 seconds.
After 3.5 years, XL got it down to 12 seconds. Dennis Gagnon had borrowed against his home and his life insurance from associates and relatives. He was tapped out at the bank, but his risk had paid off. His company had a revolutionary machine in the works, the Accelerator, which XL took to trade shows.
Literally, we had to coax people out of the aisles. Come try our hand dryer. I hate hand dryers. What do I want to try your stupid hand dryer for? So we'd get them up to the Accelerator, and they'd put their hands under, and you could see the expression in their face. There was a real wow factor to it. It's like, oh, this works.
It may still have been loud, but it actually dried your hands. Gagnon says sales for the family-owned company have gone up more than 10% every year for the past decade. In East Longmeadow, 38 people assemble the dryers in a remarkably unautomated plant.
What we're doing here, we're making our optic sensor.
The circuit boards are attached by workers armed with power screwdrivers. Dennis Gagnon says the components and machinery they use are to the greatest extent possible American. Today, XL competes with other hand dryer manufacturers. Dyson, the British vacuum cleaner company, followed XL with the Airblade. That's the dryer that you dip your hands into. World Dryer eventually came out with its own high-speed hand dryer, and there are others. But the real competition remains paper towels. George Campbell, who used to work for Dyson, now sells hand dryers of all brands through his Chicago company, Net Dryers. Using government data, they tried to measure the potential market for hand dryers.
And we came up with a number that there's roughly 30 million bathrooms away from home in the United States, ballpark, give or take. paper towels alone without hand dryers are probably in around 90 to 95% of those bathrooms.
That would mean that there are well over 25 million bathrooms that are potential hand dryer installations. The argument for the product is twofold, as Campbell tells it. First, it's cheap. Hand dryers are low-maintenance machines, and they don't require someone to stock clean towels and cart away used ones. An accelerator is especially cheap. The basic model costs all of $400. Second is the sustainability argument. That 12 seconds of drying time uses some electricity, but Campbell quotes research from MIT, research that Dyson actually commissioned, that makes paper towels out to be the real energy guzzlers.
If you measure the weight of the carbon it takes to make the paper, manufacture it, deliver it with vehicles back and forth, dispose of it by vehicles back and forth, the actual weight of the carbon footprint of a paper towel is 4 times the weight of the towel itself.
So the hand dryer makers claim to be the rare manufacturers who are both green and cheap. And they have big designs on what Campbell calls the bathroom away from home. Back at Xcel's plant in Massachusetts, Dennis Gagnon's son and Xcel Vice President Bill Gagnon treated me to a glimpse of the future.
Okay, well, you're going to see something that not a lot of people have seen back here.
In their R&D room, there's a model of a sink that made its debut before Christmas. It's in the ladies' room near the shoe department of the flagship Macy's in Manhattan. It's a trough, and at each position, there are what appear to be 3 nozzles. Put your hands under the one on the left, and a sensor dispenses soap. The one in the middle dispenses water the same way. And on the right is the nozzle of the accelerator. The rest of it is tucked underneath, out of sight.
Ah. So you get a personalized, proper hand washing without having to move.
There are some who argue against hand dryers. The paper towel industry points to studies that find that they blow germs around. The hand dryer people cite a Mayo Clinic study that suggests the question of germs is answered by how you wash, not how you dry. As I asked George Campbell, there's also the fact that when I spill coffee on my desk, I can't say, "Help, bring me the hand dryer." And Campbell told me what he says he tells prospective buyers of hand dryers.
They don't open a door, shut a sink, clean your face, dry a spill. They're hand dryers. That's what they do. They're now doing it well. And they're doing it with low energy, and they're doing it in a way that a lot of people do enjoy.
So here's a question about hand dryers. If an American entrepreneur, an American shop of inventors, and a skilled American workforce can think up and manufacture a very successful appliance, one that is globally competitive, by the way, Xcel says it has 800 accelerators at London's Heathrow Airport alone, why is it that the motor inside the accelerator, perhaps not the brains, but the guts of the thing, is made in Asia? We'll address that question tomorrow.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. First up, our look ahead at the week's tech news, and we're going to focus on Colorado, where lawmakers will begin debating a bill that would allow driverless cars in the state. NPR's Laura Seidel joins me now to talk about it. And Laura, Colorado is one of several states to take up legislation on driverless cars. Why now?
Well, Google has been the leader on this one, and the company actually built a prototype, and it's been pushing lawmakers around the country to make it possible to legally take these cars on the road. California was the first to take up legislation on this, but we also have Nevada and Florida.
But aren't we still many years away from a viable driverless car?
In fact, Google has actually said these cars are about a decade away from really being affordable and ready for the average consumer. I should note that some form of driverless car was first predicted in 1940, Robert. Mm-hmm. However, Google is really putting a lot of energy, research, and money into it. So in this instance, we may be closer than we were in 1940.
Well, why is Google so invested in this?
Good question. There's some speculation that Google actually wants to build cars and get into the car business. But if you ask Google, it says, hey, we're trying to do good for humanity. And the idea of a driverless car may make some of us a little squeamish, i.e. me. The truth is that they may actually be much safer than having you or me behind the wheel. According to most surveys, the vast majority, and I'm talking more than 90% of all accidents, are caused by human error. A car driven by a computer will have, shall we say, much better access to all the information about traffic that our brains can't process. So it'll be able to carefully measure how close you are to the car in front of you and behind you. The National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration is actually planning to do more research on this, but the head of the agency, David Strickland, says that these cars hold great promise for reduced crashes.
Now, would the Colorado law say let you actually therefore text and drive at the same time, since the car is doing the driving? Yeah.
Yes, you can do it legally, at least according to the Denver Post. They reported that the Colorado law would indeed allow you to text while you let your car do the driving. And to be clear, though, you will still have to have a license.
This could be terrible. Could you watch television while you're driving instead of being limited to radio?
Yeah, you're right. It could be terrible. In fact, I think you could.
Is Google the only company that's actually working on driverless cars this seriously?
No. Actually, in the past year, for example, at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Audi and Toyota debuted their newest autonomous cars, and the Audi model had the ability to park itself inside a multi-story garage. But I think what you're going to see is degrees of computer control of our cars. But the truth is, every major auto manufacturer is currently working on some version of a driverless car.
Okay, thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Laura Seidel.
And let's talk about another company in transition. Dell is taking itself private in a deal worth more than $24 billion. So it's going off the stock market. The stock's being bought up by people, including the founder, Michael Dell. The question for analysts is whether this will leave the company in better position to compete. Here's NPR's Steve Henn.
For Michael Dell to take the company he founded almost 30 years ago private, the company will have to borrow something in the neighborhood of $15 billion. And Horace Dedu, an industry analyst, says over time that big new debt will place a drain on Dell's cash.
The idea that Dell would somehow retool for growth under private ownership doesn't stand the harsh light of reality.
He believes taking Dell private might maximize the return to big shareholders as the company declines, but it won't spark innovation and it will drain the company's resources. The thing is, right now at least, Dell is still profitable. Last year, it earned more than $3.5 billion, but its market share is slipping. It's been left behind as personal computing has gone mobile. Bob O'Donnell follows the industry at IDC.
We do see some of the tasks for which you needed a PC now being done on these other devices.
So O'Donnell says people are buying PCs less frequently, and Dell still hasn't introduced a successful tablet or smartphone. The company's prospects in that space seem bleak. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.